regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed.
185,000 pages.
Now, public accountability and transparency, there will be no public support.
Is this really the best we can do?
If there's a regulation that doesn't make any sense, why do you keep
it? Do you know who wrote the regulatory laws you must comply with?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
On November 2nd, the Regulatory Transparency Project hosted a virtual event on the FTC's revolution through rulemaking. The following is a recording from that event. Please enjoy.
Good afternoon and welcome to this Regulatory Transparency Project webinar. Today, our theme is the FTC's revolution through rulemaking. It's an important topic and we've gathered a great group to discuss it. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I am Vice President and Director of RTP. Per usual, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of our guests. Today, we're happy to once again have the expert guidance of Svetlana Gans to moderate this discussion. Svetlana is the Vice President and Associate General Counsel at NCTA, where she advances their policy positions on competition, privacy, and advertising issues through federal agencies and Congress. Previously, she served as the Chief of Staff for FTC Acting Commissioner Maureen Olhausen. She presently serves on the Council of the ABA's Antitrust Section, and she is very involved in our RTP efforts, and we continue to be grateful for everything she does for us. If you'd like to learn more about all of our guests today, you can visit our website, regproject.org, where we have everyone's complete bios. In a moment, I'll turn it over to Svetlana. Once our panel has had an ample time to debate and discuss our topic, we'll go to audience Q&A. So please think of the difficult questions you'd like to ask them. Audience questions can be submitted via the Zoom raised hand function. If you raise your hand, we'll do our best to call on everyone in order. With that, thank you everyone for being with us today. Svetlana, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you so much, Nate. And thank you to the RTP and FedSoc team for all of your assistance with today's panel. So today we're speaking about FTC revolution through rulemaking. As some of you saw earlier in the year, the FTC announced the creation of a new rulemaking group within the FTC's Office of General Counsel. The group has been instructed to take a strategic approach to rulemaking across all of FTC's authorities and missions, both to strengthen existing rules and to create new rules to ban unfair methods of competition, deceptive practices, and unfair practices. The FTC will cover not only potentially persistent old scams, but also, quote, novel harms of the digital economy. More recently, the FTC has streamlined its Section 18 UDAP authority to give more power to the chair's office to oversee the rulemaking proceedings within the agency and to select the specific material facts that would go to support rulemaking. The FTC chair has also opened reviews of several petitions for competition rulemaking and is said to be working on privacy rulemaking. Although the FTC has long been seen as a law enforcer, it is quietly transforming into a market regulator, preferring rulemaking to case-by-case enforcement. But what exactly is FTC's rulemaking authority? What is the FTC's history with rulemaking? What conduct can be banned by rule? And what is FTC's burden of proof to show prevalence? Is FTC subject to AWIRA obligations? And where do we go from here? To help answer these questions, we have brought forward an all-star panel of experts who will opine on both the statutory authority and the potential areas of FTC rulemaking. Let me introduce the panelists very briefly, and then we'll move over to panel Q&A. First, we have with us Bill Blumenthal. He's a partner at Sidley Austin, where he advises clients across a wide array of industries and on all aspects of antitrust and consumer protection law, including mergers and acquisitions, joint ventures, horizontal and vertical restraints, monopolization, privacy, and financial practices. He is the FTC's former general counsel. Next, we have Dr. Andrew Stivers. He's an associate director at NERA, where he specializes in the economics of consumer markets in the regulatory and law enforcement action space. Prior to joining NERA, he was a senior official within the FTC's Bureau of Economics, where he oversaw all economic analysis of consumer protection matters, including proposed rulemakings. Next, we have Corbin Rothhold. He is at Tech Freedom. He is the Internet Policy Counsel and Director of Appellate Litigation. Corbin received his JD from University of California, Berkeley School of Law, and also a degree from the London School of Economics. He focuses on administrative law, the separation of powers, antitrust, tech policy, among other issues. So thank you all panelists for being here. We will do a quick Q&A session with the panelists. But as Nate said, if the audience has any questions, we encourage you to please raise your hand or utilize the chat feature in your Zoom, and we will try to call on you if there's time remaining. So Bill, I did provide the listeners here a brief introduction on FTC rulemaking, and I wanted to see if you could walk us through the FTC's history with rulemaking.
Sure, and Svetlana Fedsock, Nate, thanks for having me. The really short answer is, with respect to the type of rulemaking we're talking about today, there essentially is no history. I mean, the history is non-history. When we talk about FTC rules, you know, the stuff in Code of Federal Regulations, I tend to box them into three different categories. The first would be rules that are promulgated pursuant to acts of Congress, you know, specific acts of Congress, where there's a particular issue, a particular statute other than the FTC Act, and Congress has given authority to the FTC and often a mandate to the FTC to issue regs. So, you know, when you think about that, most of what we think about as FTC regs today, at least, are in that category, right? Fair credit reporting, do not call children's online privacy, you know, fur labeling, textile labeling, wool labeling, a whole laundry list of others. All of those are pursuant to specific authority in specific acts of Congress. A second category would be regs relating to unfair and deceptive acts and practices, the so-called UDAP stuff. And most of those are pretty old and cold for reasons I'll go into in a moment. But, you know, there are things like the picture tube rule that was repealed a couple of years ago, care labeling, the reason that, you know, on the back of this shirt, there's a little label telling me how to launder it, right? That's a relic of the 1970s. Door-to-door sales rule that gives you, 3 days to cancel your Fuller Brush order, stuff like that. And, I'll unpack that a little bit in a second, too. And then you have unfair methods of competition, which is mainly what we're talking about today. And that's, kind of one and a half rules over the 100-year history of the FTC, where one of the one and a half was repealed. That one was, there was a rule in the late 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, prohibiting price discrimination in men's and boys' tailored clothing. But that was repealed. That was an unfair methods of competition rule. That's really the one. There's a half rule, the octane rule, the yellow stickers you see on the gas pump. That was justified by reference to both unfair methods of competition and unfair and deceptive practices. So that's still in force, and that's up there. And that's kind of your one remnant of an unfair methods of competition rule. A couple of words more about the history. Let me sort of take it back to almost the first principles. You know, I've been bandying about some terms here, and let me unpack those. If you take it back to the time of formation, right, 1914, Big Bang, FTC is created. That was because Congress thought the antitrust laws as they existed at that point weren't working adequately, and they gave the FTC authority to bring cases challenging unfair methods of competition. And at that point, that's as far as it went. There was a long list of housekeeping details on how the agency would work, what authorities the agency had. One of those details was Section 6G, which we'll talk about more. And that's the one that gave the agency the right to compile a register of corporations and to issue regulations. But at that point, and for at least 50 years afterwards, everybody thought that when they said regulations, Congress meant housekeeping regulations, not regulations of industry. The FTC brought a whole bunch of cases, including against what we today would call deceptive practices, but they didn't have authority against unfair and deceptive practices at that point. It was only unfair methods of competition. A bunch of those cases were thrown out in the courts, with the court saying, this isn't a competition issue, this is a deception issue, this doesn't count. Congress responded in the 1930s by broadening the FTC's authority to include not only unfair methods of competition, but unfair and deceptive practices as well. So that's where, you know, kind of those two strands come from. Still no regulations, right? I mean, Congress kept hearing from the FTC all through this period, you know, into the 1940s, 1950s, into the 1960s. We don't think we have authority to promulgate regs. That's why we bring these as cases, as litigated cases. But that changed in the 60s. The agency started bringing, started issuing trade regulation rules. Again, all of these were unfair and deceptive practices rules. They were not competition rules. You know, the one exception being the octane rule. And that ended up in litigation. Part of what was being litigated there was whether Congress had given in 6G authority to the agency to promulgate rules of this type. And in the National Petroleum Refiners case, which I'm sure we'll talk about some more, the DC Circuit, with a panel that is, you know, by today's standards regarded as pretty activist, said, yeah, the agency has authority. 6G gives them that authority. The agency went, you know, a little wild in exercising it. And what that led to was the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act in the mid-70s that said, okay, we see you've been bringing all of these unfair and deceptive practices regulations. We think you're going a little bit overboard here. And instead of having standard APA rulemaking authority with respect to UDAP regs, here's a new statute. And here are a whole bunch of additional processes you need to follow. And yeah, it's cumbersome, but you know, due process is kind of cumbersome at times, and that's what we think is indicated here. That largely shut the regulatory shop with respect to unfair and deceptive acts and practices, because the requirements to pass one of those regulations, it becomes so onerous. There hasn't been anything in unfair methods of competition since. So for the last five decades, last half century, what we've been looking at are narrow regulations arising from specific authority of Congress. That's the history.
Got it. That's super helpful. Corbin, let me turn it over to you. So Bill mentioned 6G and the National Petroleum case. I know Tech Freedom has done a lot of research on kind of statutory rulemaking authority. Can you kind of give your sense and your read on 6G and the National Petroleum case and more generally kind of where you see the FTC's UMC rulemaking going?
Sure. Thank you, Svetlana. So we know that Chair Khan thinks the FTC has UMC rulemaking authority because she said as much in a law review article before being appointed. And it's pretty clear that she intends to use that authority because the agency recently sought comment on two petitions for rulemaking in the UMC context. Both of those petitions were submitted by a coalition led by the Open Markets Institute. One of them seeks to bar non-compete clauses in worker contracts. The other seeks to bar dominant firms from various forms of exclusive dealing. Now, the agency said when it invited those comments that it has heard from the public, quote, about a wide range of terms that may create power asymmetries that disadvantage small businesses, workers, and or consumers. So the agency simply included the two petitions for reference, and it invited additional examples. And not surprisingly, commenters presented a wide wish list of other rules they'd like to see. There were requests to ban NDAs, to regulate music industry contracts, to create non-discrimination rules for pharmacy benefit managers, to create computer right to repair rules, and more. So in the short term, to take your last question first, you know, I think it's likely the FTC will give notice of a rulemaking on contracts. And the question is simply, how broad or narrow will it go? Will it try to protect small businesses? Will it set rules industry by industry, and so on? We'll likely learn what they plan to do in an NPRM issued probably soon after there's a full slate of commissioners again. In the slightly longer term, what the agency will do is, of course, more speculative. It certainly seems from the outside like Chair Khan is going to be willing to test the boundary between UMC authority and UDAP authority. Maybe we can get into that a bit more later. I think it's possible they could try to force a set of privacy rules down the UMC route. I think pretty much anything that you see in terms of antitrust on the Hill, such as bans on self-preferencing or data portability requirements, could potentially find its way into a UMC rulemaking. But again, that's speculative. But to get to the big question, you know, okay, so does the FTC have the authority to set binding rules governing unfair methods of competition to begin with? And, you know, they don't have it in Section 5, which is a first big clue that they don't have it at all. Section 5 sets forth, of course, in detail the procedures the agency has to use for its case-by-case unfair methods of competition antitrust enforcement. And the agency, you know, must file a complaint against the specific party and collect evidence and hold a hearing and issue an order containing findings of fact. These are important due process protections. And when the FTC was passed in 1914 and for a long time after, as Bill mentioned, everyone understood that this part of the FTC created, the FTC Act created a quasi-judicial body, as the Supreme Court put it. And even Justice Brandeis acknowledged, you know, that the FTC was created in its Section 5 powers as an administrative tribunal. And as Bill also mentioned, you know, those who want the FTC to engage in UMC rulemaking, they don't look to Section 5, they look to Section 6. And Section 6 is this long provision on investigations. It lets the FTC gather and compile and report information about how firms are operating. There's this single sentence in Section 6G that says the originally it read, from time to time, the agency has the power to classify corporations and to make rules and regulations for the purpose of carrying out the provisions of this act. I recommend going and looking at the section itself. You get a sense of what a little mouse hole this sentence is compared to the elephant of FTC UMC rulemaking authority. And another thing to notice is how far removed Section 6G is from Section 5. That's an important structural clue here. It's almost like these started out as two entirely distinct bills. And it turns out they did. Section 6G originated in a House bill that created only investigative authority for the FTC. Section 5 originated in a later Senate bill that provided both adjudicative and investigative authority, but that contained no rulemaking provision. So the conference committee that reconciled the bills had only the investigative rulemaking provision before it, which, by the way, shed some light on that vestigial tale about classifying corporations. That is pretty clearly there to ensure that the FTC could define in detail which firms would be covered by the agency's investigative demands. Anyway, Section 5, you have all these due process protections for case-by-case UMC adjudication. And then you have this isolated line in Section 6 about rulemaking. So it should be pretty clear that the two things are not related. And this is actually further confirmed by the conventions of legislative drafting that prevailed at the time. You might think that Section 6G sort of inherently reads as like a housekeeping provision, like a nod to an agency's need to set and clarify its own procedures. And that's correct. I mean, when the act was passed, the way it worked was that a naked rules for carrying out clause, one that never says what penalty attaches to a rule violation, grants an agency the power to set rules governing the agency itself and not the public at large. And Professor Thomas Merrill and Professor Catherine Watts have a great law review article on this for anyone who's interested. Anyway, as Bill also noted, the FTC itself repeatedly acknowledged that it lacks UMC rulemaking authority, but then it changed its tune in the 1960s and it discovered this authority in 6G, and the question went to court. Again, we've heard about the National Petroleum Refiners case, and I would say the district court in that case got it right, basically. And it discussed how Section 5 and Section 6, the distinctions, and a lot of what I've already covered. But again, as Bill mentioned, the DC Circuit reversed. And I would sort of politely describe that decision as a product of its time. It mentions the underlying purpose of the FTC Act a lot, and it plays up the benefits, as far as the court saw it, of rulemaking. It's pretty intensely result-oriented. That said, it's the only precedent that directly addresses the issue, I believe. And those who support UMC rulemaking will probably point to cases like Chevron and City of Arlington to try and get deference for their reading. So although I've made my personal views on the question pretty clear, I don't want to make it sound like I'm certain what's going to happen when this goes to litigation, as it almost certainly will. So there's a lot more to discuss on this topic. Our time is limited. In particular, everyone should be aware that there are serious non-delegation problems with UMC rulemaking. And for more on that, you can read a piece of mine that's up at Law and Liberty today. And you can also check out Tech Freedom has submitted several comments on these issues. And I encourage anyone who wants to know more to look at those.
Great. Thanks, Corbin. And FedSoc posted both of those items in the chat. Folks can read up more on those filings and articles. Bill, Andrew, any responses to Corbin's points before we move on?
Andrew, you want first?
Okay.
Not really a response. I think the only observation is the one that Corbin made at the end, that if you were writing on a blank slate today, Corbin alluded to, there's a line from Supreme Court jurisprudence that the Congress does not hide elephants in mouse holes. And that's a line we've used often in thinking about 6G, which is sort of a mouse hole. And the regulation that's contemplated right now is quite the elephant, but there's precedent. And I think if one is looking, if one is advising a client right now, I think one has to begin by saying, the precedent in the circuit says the agency does have the authority. So you're pushing back on what, at least by some thinking, is a little bit settled, although pretty untested lately.
And if we were going to look for little clues, by the way, in the CELA law decision, there were these dueling footnotes between Chief Justice Roberts's opinion and Justice Kagan's dissent. And although it wasn't presented to her, and so this is not prejudged, but like Justice Kagan cited National Petroleum Refiners to buck it up. I mean, she treated it as authority in favor of her arguments, and she gave no sign that she, questions it.
Interesting, thanks. Bill, let me turn it back to you just to talk a little bit about process. You all mentioned that the UDAP rulemaking process is subject to MAGMAS, which is a more cumbersome process. I assume the UMC rulemaking under 6G would be more of APA-style rulemaking, but can you discuss and differentiate for us the two processes involved in terms of FTC rulemaking on these subjects?
Sure, and I think that assumption you express is correct to the extent the agency has authority at all for rulemaking under UMC. It clearly does under UDAP by virtue of MAGMAS, but MAGMAS by its terms indicates it's limited to the UDAP prong, and it explicitly carves out the UMC prong. Actually, we probably ought to flag the fact that it carves out the USMC prong. Kind of works in favor of those who would champion UMC regulations, because that was expressly carved out in a sense in MAGMAS. But the processes are, but for us, it's night and day, right? right? I mean, if there is UMC standard APA authority, that's, you know, typical APA process for non-on-the-record statutes. And what I mean by that, for those who are not familiar, that, you know, the APA distinguishes, or at least the courts distinguish between the level of investigation that the agency has to conduct if the statute requires that the rulemaking be on the record. If those magic words or words to that effect don't appear in the statute, then the process can be a little bit truncated. And most of what the FTC does, whether, you know, these days under delegated authority and specific acts of Congress, basically is standard APA rulemaking. Here's a notice of proposed rulemaking. Here's what we're thinking. Send in your comments. They will conduct a good faith review of those comments. They'll sometimes go back and modify the rule. Sometimes they'll go through a few rounds. But then the rule issues, and you're typically with 30 days notice, and you're off to the races. MAGMOS is much more cumbersome, and it's cumbersome by design. You know, in the recent internal process revisions, Svetlana, you alluded to at the intro, part of what the commission complained about was that these are cumbersome regs, that these are cumbersome requirements. But that's by design. The process begins not with an NPRM, but with an ANPRM, an advanced notice of proposed rulemaking, which invites the public to offer comment on what the set of issues is and how the agency needs to be thinking about it. Under MAGMOS, the agency needs to have a finding that the conduct at issue is prevalent. En route to that finding, you know, after the eight NPRM stage, then there's a typical NPRM. But that then kicks off a hearing process that is an on-the-record hearing process. People have to be given the opportunity to cross-examine. There have to be live witnesses. There has to be a preliminary regulatory analysis that is issued by staff before the hearing. There then has to be designation by the agency of disputed issues of material fact with opportunities for cross-examination. This was one of the details in the recent rule change. Staff has to prepare a report with recommendations to the commission based on the rulemaking record. There has to be another Federal Register notice seeking comments of at least 60 days on the staff report. There yet are additional meetings. Meetings that commissioners have had with the public have to be logged and disclosed on the record. There has to be, you know, yet a final regulatory analysis. And then when there is a statement of basis and purpose for the final rule. I mean, that's consistent with, you know, typical APA rulemaking. But then when the matter goes to court, because these are almost always litigated, then there's a special set of procedures for judicial review. So put it all together. I mean, I've just kind of gone through the laundry list of what's different, and there are a lot of elements to MAGMOS rulemaking that will just stretch out the time and make the agency do a lot more homework than it otherwise might like to.
That's super helpful. Thanks so much, Bill. Andrew, let me turn it to you. I'm interested in your thoughts, and Corbin mentioned a few of the topics that may be up for UMC rulemaking. Wanted to first ask you kind of what you're seeing in terms of consumer protection rules. We mentioned potentially privacy, but what's your sense on what the FTC is working on? And then secondly, I wanted you to maybe kickstart the discussion, picking up from where Bill left off on the prevalence requirements and how you see that play out with the Bureau and especially within the Bureau of Economics. So Andrew, well, I'll stop talking and turn it over to you.
Thanks, Svetlana. Usual disclaimer, my thoughts are my own, but thanks very much, Svetlana, for including me in the panel. So as Corbin suggested, you know, there is going to be a fair amount of speculation about where the FTC goes with its rulemaking. Obviously, they have said that they're interested in privacy rulemaking to the extent that Congress doesn't provide them a framework to build rulemaking on, they may go ahead with that. The caveat there is that privacy rulemaking is likely to be very complicated and contentious. One of the things that we have seen so far is an interest as well in much more limited specific rulemakings, again, as Bill and Corbin both suggested. You know, things like former Commissioner Chopra had suggested that government imposter cases could be turned into a rule, simply rewritten as a rule, as he put it. Dark patterns have been suggested as a potential area for rulemaking. Automobile add-ons, again, as a possibility. And all of these things are, you could relatively easily, and none of this rulemaking is that easy, but you could relatively easily identify specific practices that were generally considered to be bad, right? That they were just, you know, kind of unequivocally, you know, if somebody says they're the government and they're not, that's bad. And over the summer, the commission did pass they passed a new rule on Made in USA. And that was an interesting rulemaking because they had developed a technical definition of what Made in USA meant over, as they said, a couple decades of back and forth with thinking about these things. And they simply incorporated that into a rule. They had a specific technical definition and they said, well, you can't say Made in the USA. And that's often going to be a very explicit claim that is made. And so that makes it a relatively simple rulemaking, right? Here's the definition. If you don't meet this definition, you can't make this particular claim. But one of the difficulties in general with UDAP rulemaking is that Section 5 is a performance standard, right? I mean, it boils down to, and this is very simplified, but it boils down to don't do things that harm consumers, right? Well, that standard is by design is quite flexible, right? We give the commission the authority to say, look, ex post, go out and figure out, you know, look at practices, see if they've harmed, and if they have, you know, smack people around. With a regulation, you're trying to set out ahead of time, you know, here are the things that we don't want you to do. But simply saying, you know, hey, you know, don't harm consumers doesn't actually give firms or consumers really any guidance as to, you know, first of all, what is the standard? Like, you know, how do I determine what's harmful? And then how do I measure that relative to what my practices really are? So that makes it a lot more complex. And that, you know, pointing to something like privacy, where there are inherent trade-offs with privacy, depending on the situation that you're in. There may be some particular cases where you can say, look, we just don't want information to be transmitted in this particular instance. But there are other situations, like in credit markets, where you absolutely need that information to flow and to be validated. So that kind of complexity, I think, is going to be quite difficult. And to kind of flow back into some of the things that Bill was talking about, one of the interesting things is that it's not entirely clear to me that the stipulation that there be a regulatory analysis is actually meaningful. There's no definition of what that analysis would be. And if you look at the MUSA rulemaking, which again is slightly different, but they simply declared, yeah, this is a good thing. It's not gonna have any effect on small business, off we go. So it's not entirely clear to me that the FTC is gonna feel compelled to really lay out a cost-benefit analysis in any kind of rigorous way. And in particular, in privacy, when you look at the privacy rules, the GDPR, what EU has done, what the states have done, I have not seen any, you know, really rigorous attempt to address these trade-offs. There's simply kind of a declaration, look, you know, we've decided we want these kinds of rights, really, and we're gonna impose them. And that's, to me, one of the really interesting things about the FTC doing this, which has been very much sort of focused on, hey, let's make markets work. We're gonna set out the rules for making markets work. But with something like privacy, they're actually gonna have to start making decisions about, well, you know, here are the kinds of things that we're going to allow in the marketplace, even though there's some real trade-offs.
So, Andrew, can you elaborate from like the Bureau of Economics perspective, how would one assess the trade-offs? You know, you have like the prevalency requirement in terms of the conduct that's prevalent in the market, but then you kind of have these value judgments, which is, you know, reason why, for example, Commissioner Phillips and Wilson prefer, and I think all commissioners prefer federal privacy legislation for Congress and not the FTC to make some of these value judgments when it comes to consumer privacy in particular. But can you kind of go through kind of what the FTC will look at for prevalency and then just the economic analysis? What kinds of things would you expect the Bureau of Economics to look at in terms of the cost-benefit analysis for rulemaking?
Sure. So in terms of prevalency, that is almost certainly not a question that the Bureau of Economics will be asked to weigh in on, at least not from what I've seen so far. And part of the problem is that the statements that I've seen so far are basically like, well, we've brought cases. And, you know, maybe we brought a fair number of cases, therefore it's prevalent. Typically, an economist is going to wonder, well, what's the right denominator? Like, is this, you know, 0.01% of firms or transactions, you know, have this kind of thing? Or, you know, is it, you know, a prevalent practice that really, you know, needs a strong hand to stamp out to help consumers? And that kind of thing, it's very difficult to ascertain. And I don't think that there's going to be a lot of stomach for the FTC to actually provide as much clarity with that. In terms of cost benefit, you know, again, as a market-based agency, really what we have been most focused on is, you know, what are the effects on consumers? And we look to consumer action and choices to help us understand the value, the costs and the benefits, right? So, you know, we try to be very agnostic as to, you know, is something good or bad, right? Is there a value judgment, right? If somebody wants to buy a $80,000 truck on a $40,000 a year salary, that's their business, right? They can make those choices if they really like those trucks, as long as they're not being lied to about those conditions. With privacy, you really do have to start making those value judgments about what, you know, what we're going to allow to be sold. And that is quite difficult. However, there are cases that you can find where consumers do value these things. There are some studies that have been done in terms of some of the streaming services and the privacy conditions that they have. There's been some survey evidence that suggests that people do make some decisions there. So we can potentially value those things. But in terms of kind of globally trying to estimate the costs and benefits of particular kinds of prohibitions against targeted advertising, it's going to be really hard because there's so much heterogeneity in the marketplace. And as there's a great article by Alessandra Acquisti and some co-authors called The Economics of Privacy. And one of the points the co-authors make is that, you know, privacy decisions are contextual and person-specific. And so trying to come up with sort of a global cost benefit is really difficult. And I'll just, as a final thing, I'll sort of plug, data security is a lot easier, by which I mean it's really hard, but at least with data security, we can sort of say, well, all else equal, more data security would be better. Right? I want more control over the flows of data. And by control, I don't mean holding it back necessarily. I just mean it goes or doesn't go as I choose. that at least would be what we call a vertical quality dimension. And so it would be relatively easy to come up with some sort of cost-benefit analysis, as opposed to privacy, which again, it's context specific. And so it's much more difficult to come up with some sort of global analysis there. Unfortunately, the way that, as I suggested, the way that many regulators have responded to this is simply, you know, punt and say, well, we've decided it's a good thing, which again is a fine thing for, you know, a political body to decide. It's a little bit more difficult, I think, to justify from the administrative side.
Super helpful. Bill, do you have anything to add on FTC's burden of proof with respect to, let's just say, a privacy rulemaking or a UDAP rulemaking wearing your former general counsel hat?
Well, yeah, I mean, good rulemaking is really tough to do. And it's, you know, putting the justifications together can be really tough. You know, one that I was involved in was about a decade and a half ago, the petroleum price manipulation rule. Well, most people don't know that there is a rule mandated by Congress. The FTC didn't really want to adopt the rule, but arms were twisted and the agency needed to adopt a rule prohibiting petroleum price manipulation. Well, you have two issues. I mean, the first is what do these words mean, right? What do we mean by even by petroleum? Because if what we mean is, you know, the stuff that comes out of the ground, that's one thing. What we mean is gasoline, that's another thing. If what we mean is anything that has a petroleum derivative in it, you know, this, you know, anything in modern society has a petroleum derivative in it, you know, that's a just massive scope. And, you know, then you start getting into, and that's even before you get to the, what do we mean by manipulation? So the effort to try to get institutional heads around that was awfully tough. Measuring where you drew the lines and what the cost benefits were. Well, it's not even clear if cost benefit analysis is a requirement of the exercise. I mean, I think most of us on the call would say it would be highly prudent to have a meaningful analysis of cost and benefit because you don't want to have very high adverse effects on society with relatively little benefit. That seems pretty obvious, but that's not necessarily the test. And you know, what one ends up getting to can be a situation where you may well have highly burdensome literal regs that nobody enforces because enforcement would be kind of nonsensical. That's true of a fair number of the regs we have still on the books. Or it may be that because the intervention is so rare, it's open up to political opportunism, it's open up to selective enforcement, and that can become problematic. But, you know, I mean, I can tell you that in the GC's office, I mean, the GC's office for a long time has been one of the central locations within the agency that thinks about the rulemaking process, in part because it for a long time has been a unit that deals with the Hill and deals with, you know, how rules should be structured. And, you know, these have been tough balances for a long time.
Yeah, I definitely echo that. I worked at the FDA before I was the FTC, and one of the big rules that I worked on there was the calorie rule for chain restaurants. Yeah. And, you know, Congress said, you know, if you have a chain of restaurants greater than X size, you need to, you know, label your menu. What's a restaurant? Is the 7-Eleven that sells you a, you know, slice of pizza and a Coke, is that a restaurant? Is the grocery store that has a lunch hot bar a restaurant? And then how do you, you know, regulate the calories of, say, a self-serve soda machine? You know, these things are really hard to do. And unfortunately, some of what I have seen, for example, the potential for saying, well, let's just say that government imposture is a rule violation. You simply kicked the can down the road, right? You simply said, well, we haven't actually defined which particular practices are going to be deceptive. We're simply saying, you know, Section 5 in this particular category of claims, and now with civil penalties. And again, that kind of uncertainty is going to cause a fair amount of spillover costs, I think, on legitimate business if you don't really define ahead of time specifically what the practices are. And that difference between a performance standard, which is what the Section 5 is, versus a prescriptive standard, which is often, at least on the UDAP side, you know, what these rules are. With COPPA, the Children's Online Privacy and Protection Act, you've got a specific requirement that, you know, you have to get parental assent to collect data. With care labeling, you have to put a particular label in a particular kind of garment in a particular way. You know, those are much easier to determine whether there's a violation or not. Still potentially difficult, but that exercise of defining what it is you're really regulating against is a lot trickier than it seems from, you know, 60,000 feet, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the coverage and exemption rules, the coverage and exemption of a particular rule is really tough to define. I mean, if you think about the most prevalent antitrust regulation out of the FTC these days, the one that everybody, at least every major law firm deals with, it's Hart-Scott. Right? I mean, you know, when do you have to file? And the tests in Hart-Scott are about, you know, two paragraphs. But that's given rise to 100 pages of regulation, you know, interpreting, you know, what do we mean by asset? What do we mean by voting security? You know, what do we mean by, you know, dollar? What do we mean by $15 million? How do we measure it? And, you know, virtually every major law firm in the country has one or two people who do nothing other than keep on top of coverage and exemptions in Hart-Scott. That's all they did. Somebody had to define that in creating that set of regulations. And that's going to be the case in virtually any of these regs we're talking about.
Yeah. And I guess it's even more difficult when there's no specific congressional grant of authority, right? Because then the Section 5 language is quite broad to figure out what the rules might be. Bill, let me just stick with you very quickly because I want to be mindful of time. And we do have a great audience question in the chat. As a reminder, please post any questions in the chat so we could get to you before our time expires. Bill, to what extent is FTC rulemaking subject to the OIRA process?
This is actually a more nuanced question than people typically think. I mean, the shortest version of it is that it is subject to OIRA by statute, but the executive orders dictating how OIRA is to conduct its business routinely exempt the independent agencies and have exempted the independent agencies for 40 years. There are certain things that the FTC does that remain subject to OIRA. You know, for example, surveys, right? Paperwork reduction type steps have to go to OIRA for OIRA approval. And, you know, more generally, I mean, the FTC is an executive branch agency. It's an independent establishment within the executive branch, but it is an executive branch agency. It's the reason that, you know, when there's a snow day in D.C., the FTC is subject to OPM, you know, shut the government. The president, with just a swipe of a pen, could make the regulation process at the FTC subject to OIRA. But at the moment, it's outside by virtue of prior executive orders.
That's good. One other question. So you mentioned in terms of the MAGMAS process that it's more cumbersome, that there's many opportunities or potential opportunities for public engagement. So Bill and Andrew, just from your standpoints as former FTC officials and for the folks watching who may not be cognizant of kind of the opportunities for engagement on FTC rulemaking, if you could just elaborate more on how the public can get involved with respect to the FTC rulemaking process.
Sure. Andrew, you want to take this?
You probably have a better sense of the particularities than I do. You outlined them pretty well earlier.
Okay. Well, there are a few things. I mean, the first is before the process begins, you can always call your friendly staffer or call your friendly commissioner's office and advocate for, for development of a rule, development of some intervention in a particular area. That's probably where it all starts. Or call your congressman. That's really where it all starts. And that can be done by letter, it can be done by phone call, it can be done somebody has to plant the seed of the idea. Once it gets going, the next thing to do is to take a look at what the process is that the agency has laid out in the documentation, right? If it's a standard APA process, then there's going to be opportunity for notice. That opportunity will lay out how you send the notice in. It's almost always electronic these days. Just send it in and, hope that somebody reads it. If they go the MAG-MOS route, we're really going to have to see how the agency puts that together, because that's nobody's done that in a while.
Okay, thanks. Corbin, let me ask you a great audience question. You had mentioned briefly earlier that Chevron and City of Arlington cases regarding deference. Former FTC Commissioner Chopra and Lena Khan, when she was in his office, wrote a Law Review article that discussed Chevron deference in some detail. Can you say more on whether you think Chevron deference will apply with respect to FTC rulemaking? Kind of if you could lodge an opinion on where you see Chevron deference going.
Yeah, that's such a great question. And it kind of gives me an opportunity to walk down the other side of the street and sketch out, what we might see in an argument in favor of 6G rulemaking. And so it begins actually with a previous case. I'll start with, it's called Iowa Utilities Board. So an Iowa Utilities Board, that involves the Communications Act of 1934 and the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And this was at the height of the, maybe you could call it Reaganite conservative justice affinity for deference to agencies and expansion of agency power. The Communications Act has a similar line to the FTC Act, Section 6G, about rules carrying out, but the structure is very different. I don't think they're necessarily analogous cases. But that said, Justice Scalia looked at it and said, well, rules to carry out, like, what more do you want? And basically undertook no further analysis and took those words and said, you get to make binding rules. Another problem with that case is that it skips over the convention I mentioned earlier. Section 502 of the Communications Act sets forth penalties for violating a rule set out by the commission. So it makes sense to see that as a legislative rulemaking grant, unlike 6G. Well, a few years later, City of Arlington comes along. That case involved whether or not an agency gets Chevron deference in sort of the prior question of, does it have authority to regulate at all, before it even gets to the question of, can it get deference in interpreting the meaning of the individual statute? Is it kind of on this step one? Chief Justice Roberts argued it was jurisdictional, and Scalia was having none of that. At any rate, that case, I think it's fair to say, is a strong indication, if all of the law that is sitting on the landscape right now is applied, that the FTC would get some kind of deference in saying it has 6G authority, and it would need to be a not reasonable interpretation of the statute, which I don't think it is anyway. But yeah, it's very possible they would get deference. The wild card, of course, is that the landscape is totally shifted. What I just referred to as sort of the Reaganite affinity for blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's totally changed. I mean, Arlington, the court looks very different, both in terms of who's in the majority. Justice Kennedy and Alito dissented with Chief Justice Roberts, and now there's Barrett and Kavanaugh. And of course, Justice Thomas has changed his tune on these things. He's repudiated his own opinion in Brandeis. So you know, what I would close with is, yes, they might get deference, but also aggressive FTC action is potentially putting at risk Humphrey's executor. You know, why should agency administrators be independent if they're going to act very politically? Mistretta, you know, you could potentially revive non-delegation. That's at risk. And then it could be the case that undoes Chevron. As we all know, the Supreme Court has been playing this weird sort of Cold War or something, like it refuses to apply Chevron lately. And I think it's because there's not yet an idea of what they want to do with it, and it's kind of at risk. So aggressive agency action could potentially actually undo several of those doctrines or those old established decisions.
Corbin, let me ask you this. The Supreme Court unanimously held in the AMG case that the FTC exceeded its authority when stating that it had equitable monetary relief authority. And basically, this is part of the reason why the FTC is engaging in rulemaking right now to get some kind of civil penalties for rule violations. Just wanted to get your thoughts on how does, if anyway, the AMG Supreme Court holding, whether it might be illustrative of how the court might view this specific question with respect to UMC rulemaking authority?
Sure. Obviously it's not directly on point, but it does give a feel, both in terms of the court's desire to engage in textualism, the court's unwillingness to let power grabs, shall we say, lie, like accepting them because they've existed for a long time unchallenged, getting it right instead of sort of affirming an outcome that they thought is wrong. And you also have sort of the history. The FTC engaged in a very deliberate strategy to get that 13B authority sort of beyond the word injunction. They did very well. And by the time the Supreme Court looked at it, you know, the FTC actually had some justification in saying this is settled. We have, you know, it was like 9 circuit courts, just let it go. And the Supreme Court said no. So there might be something similar here where the FTC engaged in a pretty deliberate strategy to sort of pick up 6G and get authority out of it. And they're going to say this is settled. And if AMG sends any kind of signal, it's again going to be, well, no, you know, we don't care that a lot of time's passed. And if I may add just one other quick thing, I mean, UMC looks very appealing. We heard about the rigmarole with Mag Moss. We heard about sort of the subjective values that go into privacy. Well, let's just do UMC rulemaking. It'll be so easy. Well, that route's not necessarily open to them either. I mean, the FTC engaged in some pretty aggressive case-by-case UMC enforcement in the 70s. And in the 1980s, there are 3 Court of Appeals cases that sort of smack that down and say, look, your authority is somewhat broader than the Sherman Act, but it's not a lot broader. I mean, they said things like you can't curtail the freedom of action that has marked our country's competitive system was one of them. You know, you can't get into socio-political values, said another. They said you can kind of do like incipient violations of the Sherman Act, but if you read them with the eye of the present, those decisions kind of say you can't use your Section 5 UMC authority to engage in like a neo-Brandeisian approach necessarily. So they might be thwarted kind of coming and going.
Okay, so we have just 3 minutes left and I don't see any audience question. Nate, I'm not sure if you see any raised hands on your end. I don't see any, but I guess one last question for the panel. And this has been an excellent discussion, so it's been wonderful. Thank you so much. I guess looking in your crystal ball, in terms of predicting the future, we've spoken about the fact that FTC has one petition for rulemaking on the UMC side to cover non-competes and exclusive provisions in contracts. Looking at your crystal ball, of course, is just sheer speculation, but where do you see the FTC headed after, you know, that you receive public comments, the record is closed? What would be the next step in your mind on this UMC rulemaking? Bill, I'll start with you, and then Corbin, and then Andrew, if that works.
I think they're going to find it to be a lot tougher than they. I mean, there won't be a generalized, you know, what is an unfair method of competition. It's going to be focusing on very particular practices. And I think as they try to unpack what practices should or should not be covered, and you know exactly what are the boundaries of what is covered and what is exempt, what do we mean by the word? When I was at the agency, we used to talk a lot about Henry II, right? The old play. When Henry II said, "Well, no one rid me of this troublesome priest or turbulent priest, whatever the phrase is," he didn't mean assassinate the guy on my behalf. And I think the agency is going to find that as they try to prohibit unfair methods of competition, the terminology is not going to be nearly so readily apparent as what people had in mind.
Corbin, what are your thoughts?
I like to talk about how Thomas Beckett is actually an interesting case of the executive removal power. I'm just going to let that sit there. Obviously I don't have a crystal ball. It's hard because any administration, you're kind of on a clock. You would think what they would want to do is maybe pass a narrow exclusive dealing rule. I mean, exclusivity is such a broad thing. It's such a broad terrain. And what they're basically trying to do is thwart good, solid rule of reason analysis because it's time consuming. They want this shortcut. So that would recommend maybe trying a broad rule, but then you're going to get into court and the broader your rule is, the more you're sort of daring the courts to just completely snap that back. So you would think maybe they would pass sort of a narrower rule, then get it into court, then see if they can get the 6G authority affirmed or learn that they don't have it and then know not to go that route. And then they'll know where to go with their privacy rulemaking if they want to do that. I guess that's maybe more what I would do if I were in their seat and my goal were to expand the power. But in terms of what they'll actually do, anyone's guess.
These things take a really long time to do right? I mean, when we tried to go after patent settlements, that was a 15-year process to get to an ultimate Supreme Court resolution. If you have 3 or 4 years, you really want to do this right, you need to do it slowly, stepwise, build the authority, build the case. You can't do that in 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. Andrew, any thoughts on where things are headed?
I think both Corbin and Bill have exactly right. You know, the question will be kind of how they gauge that strategic issue. And the attorneys at the FTC are fantastic. They're really smart. They're really strategic. They've done a fantastic job. Just look at their privacy program. They built that, piece by piece into something that I know it's popular to claim it's not, aggressive enough, et cetera, but based on what it's built on, it's amazing. And so I think that if the attorneys are allowed to build the program that they would like, the staff would like, that it'll be this slow process. I think the question is, will the commission itself feel the need to put some quick wins on the board, and say, hey, we passed this rule. And unfortunately, there's a little bit of a history of commissioners getting things on the board and then waving goodbye and it's somebody else's problem.
Great. Well, this has been a wonderful panel, super informative. I want to thank each of you for your time. I definitely learned a lot. Thank you all. And I'll turn it over to Nate for our last words.
Yeah, I would absolutely echo that. Very informative. We're certainly grateful to Svetlana, Bill, Corbin, and Andrew. Hope to have you all back again sometime soon. We welcome feedback from our audience by email at rtp@regproject.org. Thank you all for joining us. Go vote and have a great day.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.